You know, when I was putting together the order for this evening's discussion, I was kind of anxious not to put the two Chinese or Chinese extraction artists next to each other, as if to create, you know, a Chinese corner or something, thinking, no, these are four individual shows we're looking at, and let's just mix it up. But it then just didn't work with the order for the other artists, so we do have them together. And there's a temptation, I think, to be resisted in just saying, okay, well, let's ask about a Chinese aesthetic in these two works and get talking about, of course, we're dealing with an American artist of Chinese extraction and a Chinese artist living in China, different animals, fundamentally. It's as I say, tempting, but then more tempting not to be tempted to go down the route of the Chinese labyrinth, as it were. But I nonetheless find myself, having actually come back from China just last weekend, nonetheless kind of very much in Chinese mode and hard to repress thoughts about China, even when I'm looking at Bradley Slater and Miss Schnabel. So I'm therefore finding the temptation not to be tempted not so tempting. And even if I were to resist the temptation, if I just start with Sarah Zay, I'm looking at Sarah's work there at Asia Society, followed her career for as long as I have been able to, and the work there does seem to look quite distinct from earlier installations. Perhaps we all remember the installation at the Whitney Museum just a few years ago. I had the privilege to see the one at the Cartier Foundation maybe about 10 years ago now. Much less the density, the all-overness, the overload that is sort of, to my mind, a characteristic of her aesthetic. Even more than I'm used to in the work, maybe it's a misreading, and ready to be corrected, an impeccable kind of precision in a sort of almost humorously extreme and delicate preciousness and in placement of objects, in particularly the infinite line, the main body of new work, which I hope will be the focus of our discussion. Any of my panelists who are also familiar with Sarah Zay's work wish to come in on that?
Well, I was interested in there's much less what I'd call pop material in this show. Firstly, I think we focused on the pop stuff and probably put too much weight on it. In this new show, there's things like stuff she bought from the hardware store, things like, but they're not used in a pop way. I don't think they have any. It's interesting that she uses these mass materials, but not in an Andy Warhol way at all. They're kind of, that's just using them as if they were pigments or something like that. I find her extraordinarily complicated artist. Artists like Dennis Oppenheim and Alice Aycock, who also evoke architecture and space and all that, are much easier for me to grasp. I find it quite hard to grasp. Frankly, I find it quite impenetrable sometimes. In the second room, I was interested to see if she was the same. There's a little thing they use in the armed forces, this little circular device, which is a color blindness test, which is used in almost every piece. I have no idea why. I find her very baffling artist, but it's really good to look at, really interesting to look at. Frankly, I haven't figured her out.
Right. That's a good place to be, isn't it, Michelle? Perhaps to be baffled, not know what it's about, but want to look more?
Yes. I completely agree with what Anthony says. And so to deal with the complexity, I decided to focus on her apparent interest in vision, in perspective. And I take the vision thing from the prints that are on the stairs up to the show, which contain numbers that now you see, now you don't, now you see, now you don't, which of course are problems of optics. And I think she's very interested in that, and I think the complexity is a way of disguising what her principal interest is, which is line, which she turns into string, but which is still line. And perhaps in the illusion that traditional one-point perspective provides on a two-dimensional surface, and she translates this convention of Renaissance painting and drawing where you have this illusionary space, she translates it into three-dimensional space with the same idea of encouraging, of urging with certain lines that go into space toward a horizontal beam of horizon to make us feel space in a three-dimensional way, and space is emptiness. So it's very hard to convey space as something actually visible. And I don't know whether anybody will agree with me.
No, I certainly would. The sense of the void being an active place, which is philosophically very hard to grasp. It seems to negate the point of being a void, but it is nonetheless, sorry, but within Chinese aesthetics, something quite strong and something of immense force. Anna, what did you make of the openness and closeness, what did you make of the show?
I actually, on some level, didn't really look at the physical objects as much as I was interested in sort of imagining the work almost as like a vivisection of a fiction writer's creative process. And looking at it like tangents that maybe she herself wouldn't feel tempted to unravel and understand, but could sort of compile into a potential something else in process of being developed. And the reason why that was the way I relaxed into experiencing it was her use of banal kind of inspirational parts of the gallery itself, so the light fixtures, or even almost the embarrassing elements in a room that one intentionally overlooks because they're maybe a little uncomfortable, the thermostat material or plugs, things that kind of alert you to how rooms have to be functional but aren't design features. The way that she kind of worked from there and developed these imaginative kind of extrapolations made me feel like it was unfinished. So to kind of investigate it and untangle it as it existed seemed almost like disrespectful to the development that it could potentially move towards. And I think what's wonderful about her work is it seems so limitless. So that's why I said fiction, because it almost seems as though like the parameters of physical space and reality are just not relevant for her process. So in the world of fiction, anything could potentially occur if it's allowed. Yeah. That seems exactly how, if her work is allowed, it could just grow.
That's the idea of the fiction writer at work. I was fascinated by how in many instances, it looked like she'd emptied her pockets. And in other instances, you know, you had the coins that were in her pockets, a subway ticket. I was, with my failing eyesight, torturing myself to see which subway system it was. But just little receipts and things that we all seem to accumulate in our pockets. And then also the necessary equipment for putting an installation together, like masking tape and various kinds of thread that don't look like they were chosen to express something, but are rather just they are what was with the artist as she was making. So I had a very strong sense of actually a tension between this being work in progress, artist still kind of present, the little stool, so on and so forth. But and then, in contrast to that, the, as I said, exquisite preciousness with which things are, and the finality with which things are placed.
Can I add a couple of things? I went to the room on the right first, and I saw on the wall I forget the name of it. It's a little oblong device on the wall for measuring temperature.
Yeah.
And I said, boy, that looks just like a Zara Z. Yeah. Then in the next room, she's actually incorporated it in the piece.
Right.
And so she actually is, you know, sort of...
She noticed the same thing.
Yeah, she actually is making it. She's doing that knowingly. I also like the fact that some of the pieces, they're chips, they're little piles of chips underneath, as if termites have been gnawing at it, which is really like Robert Morris in The Box with Sounds of Its Own Making or something like that. The process is very much part of the work, which makes it a little less abstract and less ethereal. It makes it more real.
Yes. But, Michelle, we've noticed these ephemeral things, the shop bought that Anthony sees, and the accoutrements of the room that Anna's noticed, the contents of the pocket. But there are, nonetheless, some, apart from the colorblind test charts, very specific objects brought into these assemblages, aren't there? Do they give us, beyond the theme that you've adumbrated of perspective and the void, do they also give us some clue as to meaning or some materials to construe our own meanings from? The rocks, for instance, or the photographs?
Well, the piece which continues outside and has several Chinese garden element is the most accomplished. But my overall feeling is that the interest is not in expressing truly any subjective consciousness, even though I love the idea of her using things out of her pocket. As I say, I think that if I were to relate it to something, I would relate her work to the work of Sato. I think it's very much into phenomena
the
of
Brazilian,
perception.
Right.
Who's having a show at the Grey Art Gallery.
That
it's very analytical, and that the little things out of the pockets, all these accidental things, are to detract, to humanize artwork, which is basically cold.
Right.
And where the meaning is really what's there. The meaning is about, or at least to me, is about the research that she conducts about 2D, 3D, the threshold, the way 3D and 2D connect, et cetera, et cetera. That's how
are we sort of coming to a consensus? Anna mentioned not even looking at the actual objects. Are we coming to a sort of consensus, not that I would subscribe to it, but that... The materials are almost the artist's private business, but they're just shapes, colors, forms to be broken down in this process of making, and that the subject lies completely beyond the actual previous life of most of these materials.
Yeah, I think some objects are very solid. Those things from the hardware stores, I said, they're there, they're on the ground, they were used in making the piece. A lot of the stuff, you don't know where it is, you don't know what it came from. I don't think that's not being referred to in the piece, is it? It's just like CRR's dots, they're there for building the piece.
Right.
There is no unity in the choice of the materials, which I was just thinking about Katie Nolan and her throwaway pieces.
Right.
There is a much more directed sensibility than there is in the Z.
Right.
I don't think they're private in the way of being precious or valued by her as an individual, per se, but something that could just build to spark inspiration.
Yes, so when I said private, I didn't mean they're drawing us into the depth of her soul private. I just meant she's not making a Jesus Raphael Soto. She's not doing a Damien Hirst dot painting, but the things she's using are just actually, they may have, and they probably do have, meaning for her as things, but she's just actually maybe drawing on things to be used almost as material in the way that oil paint is a material. In other words, it's installation. But it's a very traditional painterly or sculptural approach to making an installation in this space. I'm not necessarily saying that, but I'm hearing that perhaps from the three co-panelists.
I think what influenced my interpretation of the total show so much more than maybe everyone else was the drawing she made from other people's biographies, where she held these conversations and developed these really whimsical sort of portraits based on the kind of imaginative tangents and legends. And what I loved in that was that there was one where the story clearly began with the birth of the storyteller, so it went from the hospital maternity ward upwards, and so there was this sense of kind of information being rooted and something so like fundamental and nervous way to start a story that then kind of extrapolated into this mythic kind of epic fairy tale-esque aspect. And then I took that experience and brought it into the installation room.
Yes, and that I think would vindicate Michelle's point, because it's really about a sort of, in Kant's phrase, purposiveness without purpose. So when you take somebody's story, you take somebody's, to do a portrait, you say, give me five very significant moments in your personal story. You then make your work, and then you destroy the list of the five. It keeps the energy of a significant narrative, but it loses the actual significance of that actual narrative. So it becomes a phenomenological.
I just feel, looking at them, they're quite powerful to look at, very powerful, some of them. And I suspect, as with, say, Kandinsky or Malevich, that there are buried meanings there, which are deliberately buried. You have no, otherwise, they have so much formal strength. Mm-hmm. I don't think she maybe wants you to know about any more than Malevich did, you know.
But if Anna's fiction model is valid, then if she assembles those materials for us, what she wants, her intention, becomes quite irrelevant, because we can then project onto or with those ingredients, as it were. I mean, she's in other words done some marketing, but it's for us to cook the stir fry. Mm. Well,
may I just quote what the New York Times said, because I think that bittersweet analysis is pretty relevant.
Yes,
she said it was I don't remember. Recently, Zé is an intellectual and worldly artist, one who talks about space like an architect and vision like an ophthalmologist, rhapsodizes about the shifting perspective in Chinese painting, one who sounds, in short, like the MacArthur Grant recipient and Yale graduate that she is.
I haven't read that review. It could only be Roberta Smith. But
It wasn't.
No. Oh, well, somebody's picked up Roberta's whiplash.
Yes.
Final retort. Well, okay. We like to think you don't need the New York Times if you're here, because you're getting, as Christian Vivreau's phone said, a year's worth of reviews in one evening. But let us proceed to our next artist, Ai Weiwei. And Michelle, let me start with you, as you are an authority on artists who made great work but compromised with terrible regimes. What do we make of this artist's work who won't compromise with his regime? In other words, I think the question for all the panel, or my question for myself, which I'm going to bully the panel into thinking about, is I'm sure we all applaud Ai Weiwei, the human rights activist. Does it tally with the work?
I cannot help when I read about Ai Weiwei noticing that he lived in New York in the 1980s. And who were we looking at in 1985, 86? Do you all remember?
Well, it was some of us weren't born, but tell us who you were looking at.
Oh, all right, well, all too well. It was the Coons, it was Chaim Steinbach, it was Ashley Bickerton, Peter Halley, but among the sculptors, it was really Coons, Chaim Steinbach, Alan McCollum.
Oh, we were looking at who we have to look at when we look at him in Mary Boone now, which is Bartle Kruger.
And I feel that the strategies of those artists in 1986 did not escape the notice of Al Weiwei. And by that I mean that those artists were ironists, but they were ironists who detected the signs, the connotations, denotations of everyday objects, whether it was a vacuum cleaner or a toilet cleaner or a basketball. They knew how to extract from those objects from everyday culture signs that were critical of the establishment of capitalism, of consumerism, etc., etc. And yet they made tons of money, I must admit. So the irony, the critique, was attenuated by that aspect of their work. And when I went to the opening of Al Weiwei, I happened to ask one of the people who in the gallery how much the show was selling for. And guess how much? Millions. More than a million. More than a million, and they're not supposed to be sold separately. It's going to go to a museum for at least a million. Okay, and of course, when you think about the Tate show, then it becomes several millions. But anyway, so this being said, I cannot help but put Al Weiwei in the context of this 80s period when artists very cleverly followed theory, saw everyday culture as a dictionary of signs with which to critique.
Forgive me, though, but how are sunflower seeds everyday 1980s objects?
Well, they're not 19, that's the whole point. Uh-huh. He doesn't use capitalist objects. He uses his own history, Chinese history. And if you read the little bit about him, you realize that sunflowers are a very important product of the countryside of China, where he was raised, and that sunflowers appear in communist posters because of their strange properties. As you know, sunflowers go around the sun. And so the posters which refer to that show sunflowers as being, as flowers, a type of nature, enslaved to the sun, Mao.
Right. Anna, I'm sure we're all familiar with the earlier work of Ai Weiwei when, for instance, he would use a Coca-Cola logo, which would hopefully keep Michelle happy, on a Han vase, or a reproduction of one, hopefully. But do you follow Michelle's line of thought on this, or did you have your very different feelings looking at this installation?
I did, looking at this installation, different from the Tate, because I felt like this, the way it was presenting, contained also the way that the audience was discouraged from actually really interacting with it. There was a friend of mine who was in the audience, and we were definitely told to keep a distance, which makes sense considering the health hazard that was on Earth, but definitely did create a real boundary where this particular installation really felt kind of like a souvenir. Mm-hmm. And more like a souvenir in the sense of it being kind of manufactured to be purchased and taken away than to actually be interacted with and experience as the authentic thing. So I definitely do see that element. But I also was thinking more of sunflowers in terms of they're part of the urban organic life of Chinese cities, where people chew them and spit them, and they're a lot more violent in the way that they're part of this litter and just the real kind of churning city aspect. So seeing them as kind of representatives of individuals and sort of the special unique aspects each individual has, because each one was so delicately designed and like a snowflake in its special unique qualities, versus thinking of the like manic energy of Chinese cities and sunflower seeds actually being kind of one of the most offensive parts of kind of roaming through these already really aggressive cityscapes, and just feeling kind of like as an individual your personal space is so violated, and then these sunflower seeds being a part of that, and seeing them kind of so calm and well presented, it's this sort of
pristine
souvenir, had both a sort of sentimental and a little disorientingly distanced.
Yeah,
effect.
Yeah. You need one of Jeff Koons' vacuum cleaners to clear up all the shells after the Beijingers have been chewing away on the sunflowers. Antony, there's been a very radical shift in what was the must have been the original intention of Ai Weiwei with this series now. After the Tate Gallery wasn't able to present it fully the way that was intended, there were health and safety issues, and the public couldn't sift through these porcelain. Each one of those sunflowers is hand-painted individual porcelain representations of a sunflower seed. But they created so much dust that it created a major health hazard for people to, as the artist had wanted, be able to sift them through their fingers. So it's gone from being this interactive masses of sunflowers, millions of them filling the whole of the turbine, whole of the Tate, going right up to the walls, and to being this...
It's still millions.
You're still getting our money's worth of seeds, I guess, but it must have been tens of millions then. In the
it's now six.
It's now a mere six. So a very different kind of experience, right? What do you get from this current
incarnation? I think one aide supported Michel, quite Salvador Dali, who said, Cézanne painted apples, he didn't paint carrots. You know, one paints the symbolic vegetable. Knew the symbolic vegetable. I was at the Tate also, and it was a very, you know, mildly apocalyptic experience. This was very different. I learned two things I knew already, really. One was that I went to the opening. I thought the opening was awful, because you saw this manicured little garden. I thought, my God, they've turned it into a kind of floral garden. And there was security people around and all that. But then I went back, and there was no one there. Totally different experience. I asked them, apparently Ai Weiwei decreed, I think it's 3 meters, a 3 meter gap around it. It was really quite moving. It was almost like Terence Coe. But I would say something else, which is that, and there's a bit of this in Sarah Z also, that I think there's a new kind of art, which is art where there's so much theater in it and so much architecture. If you look at the art of the past, even, you know, fairly formless art, like Pollock, like Schwitter's collage or whatever, it actually obeys the ancient harmonies almost always. You know, even earth art, even Walter de Maria, even Christo. But now we have this new sort of art, which is also big and theatrical. And it's actually very hard to judge. You either accept, hey, this is pretty good. If you look at it, and I think also of Tara Donovan or Jason Rhodes, you think, would I actually notice if that chunk was over there? And the answer is no, I wouldn't. But I like the whole theatrical effect of it, you know. But can I judge as a piece of work? Would I see if that dune of porcelain seeds was over there? I said, no, it would pass me by. I think we have to accept that this is an art that one almost judges as theatre in a way, and I find it very effective when there was no one there. When there were millions of people there, it was like going around the Kabukov thing at the Whitney. Mm. It was supposed to be an isolation ward or something, filled with people. It was me. It was robbed of meaning. Mm. But when it's all alone, it was very moving, I thought.
Yes, I'm glad you were very moved. I walked around it a few times. I also had the security guard experience. And I must say that between Mary Boone and the Damien Hirst show next door at Gagosian, I actually saw those two galleries had more uniformed custodians than the Forbidden City. But I think even if there wasn't this security guard who, because I was moving, got very suspicious of me, thought I was trying to steal a seat. Even if he wasn't, if it didn't have his heels clicking behind me as I was trying to give it as much energy as I get as much of the possibility of any kind of transport from looking at the work as possible. I just found it immensely cold. I mean, it's this beveled rectangle, so it sort of, art-wise, puts me in mind of, you couldn't. It's not even a candy you could take away and eat. But it was not. But it also puts me in mind of, say, a Richard Long arrangement of something taken from another place and put here in the gallery. Whereas I didn't see it at the Turbine Hall, but from all the photographs I saw of the Turbine Hall, I got the sense of a much more overwhelmingly sumptuous and theatrical kind of experience there than I was getting at all at Mary Boone.
Yeah, it's funny because at the Turbine Hall, I did think about Felix Gonzalez Torres and how the sunflower seeds appear to be so uniform, and so there's a sense that this is a population that's kind of been flushed with their individuality and the kind of sweetness that comes from being colorful and sort of obviously the kind of sugar high, like, frantic element in the West where there's all this bubbly sense of your creativity is sweet and something you indulge in and maybe kind of vacuous but is still sweet and exciting. And because you could really involve yourself with it, there was a real intimacy, this kind of feeling of engaging with like a human element, but there wasn't any of that at Mary Boone's.
As a cultural historian, I'd like to go into the history of those seeds, because I think that has to be raised. The seeds are made of ceramic. They're made in a city that traditionally made of great porcelain urns and all kinds of very refined objects. And the whole town was specialized in that kind of ceramics work. And I think Al Weiwei had as one of his intentions to revive this town by having them produce these individual ceramic little objects. And it's interesting, I mean, I enjoyed very much looking at the video of the whole process, which apparently has 30 different stages in the production of these little seeds, from shaping them to painting them, and all is done by these admirable and very talented crafts people in this town who now have no more work to do because their work is past. So I would like to bring this as one of the intentions of Al Weiwei, which explains.
I'm sure they're pleased for the work and the money, but it can't have been very aesthetically rewarding work to make each seed.
I imagine. I thought so, but looking at the at that video, they all seemed very pleased, and they took their little bundles of
well, they've been
plastic.
Trained in the art of looking pleased when someone's making a video.
You will notice many critics have taken pot shots at Damien for not painting his own dots.
Yes.
But no one's saying, Ai Weiwei did not make his own seeds.
Oh, no, that's for sure.
Well, he'd be... he'd have his work cut out for him if he did. But Damien's dot painters are just sort of anonymous jobbing painters. Ai Weiwei is doing something rather comparable to, say, Anthony Gormley or Boetti A. Alighieri, in actually the who is making it for him is integral to the aesthetic meaning of the work.
Yeah.
So I think that's the fundamental distinction.
Yeah.
Between
the joke.
No, well, I treat jokes seriously. But anyway, good. What do our audience have any jokes for us? We'd love to hear from you. Doesn't have to be a question, can be a comment, response to either Sarah Zay or Z or Ai Weiwei or Al Weiwei. We've been having quite a variety of pronunciations this evening. But you will have to come to the end of the row or something, improvise, work it out. We'll get to you, you'll get to us. So please raise your hands if you love to some comments. Yes, great, that's convenient.
Okay, I experienced the Ai Weiwei as like a seashore. And then when you were telling us about the process of these people in this dying business, it began to look more like a big grave, like a seashore. Because it was very quiet when I was there too, and I felt like I couldn't get close, but I could observe it in this huge, beautiful room. I mean, it was very architectural when you looked at it without the history, just as the gray tones. I quite thought it was. It reminded me a little of death, and the sea.
Death and the sea. Okay, thank you. I think I saw a hand begin to go up in the middle. Is that correct? Yeah, do that. That's best. Yes.
I was wondering if anybody thought about the environmental commentary from Weiwei. China is trying to develop. It's destroying its environment in the process. And is the commentary that these seeds turn out to be hazardous to your health something potentially that he intended people to experience?
Mm-hmm. Okay. We don't have to answer. We'll just absorb register. That as register. Thank you.
I personally know Ai Weiwei during the 80s, and while he was in New York, we used to play poker, and he win most of the time. Very good strategist. So recently, I mean, you can't get away from not reading about Ai Weiwei. Sometimes you get bombed 10 articles the same day. So that's sort of in an elevated position that you can never imagine anybody could be as an artist. He's a real person. I remember someone told me he made cover of Newsweek or something last year. So the strata that he's in make us become totally mythicized by who he is. But he's a human being. He's a person. And I think a lot of the energy came from his exile of the family during the Cultural Revolution. He's a rebel. His father was a rebel, a real communist, but got kicked out by Mao. So imagine a childhood of that nature and growing up in exile. This is Xinjiang, like border of China, no man's land. The father was cleaning toilets because he was down. So after Mao died, they came back. And these are basically elite people that got let out in the 80s when it was possible. Before that was closed. And I was one of them. And I know a whole bunch of them that came out at that time. Reference to Jeff Koons, yes. So is Keith Haring. So is Andy Warhol. So is everybody that was on the table and off the table is there. This is a total absorption from Mao to capitalist. And in terms of Jingdezhen, the place where they make the seeds and so forth, that was a historical ceramics village that still does it. And I think Ai Weiwei himself has learned a lot about capitalism during this period that was here, how these guys make so much money. We're all talking about millionaires, Andy Warhol, Jeff Koons, Of course he wants to be one. So here's an opportunity. Okay, a dollar a sunflower seed. That's cheap. Okay, and he's going to sell that piece.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you. It's great to have a account from a friend who goes way back. Excellent. Good. Yes, good.
Okay, I just wanted to ask if this sort of backstory on Ai Weiwei is so important, especially that video of how the sunflower seeds are made and the town where it's made and all of that. Why isn't more of that material shown with the artwork? If we need to know that to appreciate it, really.
Good question.
I didn't get the question.
There's another one there.
When I was seeing both Sarah Z and Ai Weiwei, I see this proliferation of detail and information, and that to me is, I wonder if it references nature, if it references on both levels the amount of leaves in a forest, the amount of elements that Sarah Z works with, or the sheer number of sunflower seeds. To me, I wonder if that has occurred to anybody, or if that's that they could be referencing just the sheer quantity
with
in
Sarah,
nature.
Oh, with Sarah Z, definitely. I had this sense it was like a mold, and the way it was developing seemed potentially unhealthy, but it seemed as if the way sort of black mold grows in a room and can kind of have these interesting patterns, even though those patterns are undesigned and whatever sort of method or meaning there would be to them would have to be imposed by someone who wasn't fully understanding what they were looking at and the the natural and controllable aspects of it, but could potentially find them embedded. I think definitely with her, there's that feeling that if left alone, like if the room were locked, those pieces would continue to like overtake.
Fantastic. Yes, one more comment, then we must move on to our other shows.
I just think you brought up a very interesting thought about how the two installations at the Tate and here in New York were so different. And the first one was, you were supposed to be involved and it was free and feeling the sunflower seeds. And the second, this installation is so rigid and controlled and contained. And I just wonder if, did his intention and his message change and evolve through that experience? Or do you think the intention and the message remain the same with the two very different installations?
I would like to bring up something that may be a little too simple-minded, but I saw a video of Ai Weiwei walking on the piece at the Tate, and the sound was the sound of crushing. And therefore, I said, aha, so those seeds are Chinese people who are being crushed by this big, powerful man. And when I saw the show at the Mary Boone, aha, now the guards are protecting the little people, the little seeds. But it's a little simple-minded, I'll grant you.
Yeah, I would say that Ai Weiwei has been savagely beaten up by the Chinese police. He's obviously an extremely courageous man. And I don't think it's incidental that Ai Weiwei in China, Voina in Russia, and maybe William Kentridge in South Africa, who have the good fortune to be making art in countries with fewer freedoms, the United States, are making very great art.
Excellent. Okay. Well, let's move on to our second batch of shows then.